Ekhatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary have been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Okay, so today we're stepping into, well, what a lot of people think of as this kind of marble oracle.
Yeah, the U.S. Supreme Court delivering objective, almost godlike law, right?
Exactly. But that's maybe not the full picture.
Not really, no. And that's what we're digging into today, based on the fantastic work of Linda Greenhouse. We're trying to strip away some of that mystique.
Right. To see the court less as this infallible, quasi-divine thing and more as, well, a deeply human place.
A place where law, sure, but also personality, history, and, yeah, politics all kind of smash together.
And the big question Greenhouse really tackles is this huge paradox, isn't it? You've got 9 judges, unelected, appointed for life.
For life.
And they wield this absolutely immense power in a democracy. How does that even work?
And more than that, why does all that power seem to balance on something so fragile, like public trust? That paradox. Huge power, but totally dependent on us, the public, accepting it. That feels like the main thing we need to grasp, right?
Absolutely. It's the lens for understanding everything else. We need to see how it works and maybe where it, you know, falls short sometimes.
Okay, let's get into it. And the guys we're using, Linda Greenhouse. We should probably talk about her first. Why is her perspective so valuable here?
Oh, definitely. Her authority is just immense. It's not just academic theory. She lived it.
Right. She was the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times for, what was it, 30 years?
30 years, 1978 to 2008. Think about that. She saw the court through the Berger years, the Rehnquist years, right into the beginning of the Roberts Court. That's incredible institutional memory.
And she's got this amazing blend, too. A Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, so focused on objectivity, but also a Yale Law School grad. She gets the legal nuances.
Exactly. That's the magic combination. It means she saw the justices not just as names on opinions, but as actual people.
People with personalities, leadership styles.
Yeah, how the Chief Justice might manage the dynamics in that very private conference room. How the political context weighed on them. She makes it history, but like living history, not just case names.
Okay, so her book, The U.S. Supreme Court, how does she frame it? Is it like a dense legal textbook?
No, not at all. That's the beauty of it. It's really presented as a primer, you know, for the curious citizen. Accessible, relevant, not bogged down in jargon.
So where does she start the story?
Well, she kind of traces the court's journey from what Alexander Hamilton famously called the least dangerous branch.
Right, because it didn't have the power of the purse, like Congress, or the sword, like the president.
Precisely. But then came the big shift, the moment the court really started becoming a co-equal branch. And that hinges on one key doctrine, judicial review.
Ah, yes. Marbury v. Madison. 1803. That's the one everyone learns about.
It is. And Greenhouse really highlights what a brilliant, almost strategic move it was by Chief Justice John Marshall.
He couldn't actually force the president's administration to do what the case was technically about.
Right. He knew he'd lose that fight. So instead, he sidestepped the immediate issue, but in the process, claimed this monumental power for the court itself.
The power to say, this law passed by Congress, or this action by the president, it violates the Constitution, so it's void.
Exactly. A total game changer. And from that foundation, Greenhouse shows how the court constantly wrestles with this fundamental tension, the tension between law and politics.
And that feels like the honest truth, doesn't it? They're supposed to follow the law, precedent.
Your decisis, yeah. Respecting past decisions.
But they're also human. Appointed by presidents with political agendas, they have their own judicial philosophies, which, let's be honest, often line up with political views.
And Greenhouse is really clear. You can't neatly separate the two. The court has always been both legal and political. The real story is how it navigates that constant push and pull.
Okay, so how does it navigate that? Let's get into the mechanics. How does the court actually do its work day to day?
Greenhouse pulls back the curtain on this, and one of the most stunning things is just how much power they have as essentially gatekeepers.
You mean deciding which cases to even hear?
Exactly. They get thousands of petitions each year, these requests called writs of certiorari, thousands.
And they hear what, like under 100? 70, 80 maybe?
Something like that. It's a tiny fraction. So just by choosing which cases make the cut, they are setting the national legal agenda. deciding which issues get debated at the highest level.
How do they even decide? Is it majority rules?
Ah, no. And this is fascinating. It's the unwritten rule of four.
Rule of four, meaning?
Meaning it only takes four justices, just four out of the nine, to agree to hear a case. Certiorari is granted if four say yes.
Wait, hang on. Four, not five. So a minority of the court can put a case on the docket, even if the other five don't want to hear it.
That's right. Four justices can decide, this issue is important enough, we need to rule on it. It gives a minority significant agenda-setting power.
That's, wow. And Greenhouse points out the flip side, too. The power in not hearing a case.
Oh, absolutely. Denying cert can be just as impactful. It leaves the lower court's decision in place, which might be the law for millions of people in that circuit. It's a kind of passive power, deciding by not deciding.
Okay, so once the four votes are there, the case is on the docket. What happens next? Does it get really public then?
Well, you have the public arguments, yes, but a crucial part happens entirely in secret, the justices' private conference.
Right. This is where they discuss the cases they've heard and take their initial votes.
Exactly. Just the justices in the room, no clerks, no recordings we know of. This is where the real deliberation, the persuasion, the negotiation happens.
And where the Chief Justice assigns who writes the majority opinion.
Yes, if the Chief is in the majority. If not, the most senior justice in the majority assigns it, and who writes it can really shape the final reasoning.
But it's not just about the winning side, is it? Greenhouse talks about dissenting opinions, too.
She really emphasizes their importance. A dissent isn't just sour grapes. It's often a carefully argued legal position, laying out why the majority is wrong.
Like planting a flag for the future.
Precisely. A powerful dissent can provide the arguments, the framework, for lawyers and future justices to potentially overturn that precedent down the line. It keeps the conversation going across generations.
Okay, that covers the process. What about the people? The justices themselves, the whole life tenure thing is huge.
It's fundamental. The idea, going back to the founders, was to insulate judges from the whims of politics, give them job security so they can make unpopular decisions without fear of being fired.
Makes sense in theory. But Greenhouse suggests it kind of backfires sometimes in our modern, highly polarized world, right?
Well, yeah, because the stakes of each appointment become astronomical.
Because that one person could be shaping American law for 30, 40 years, long after the president who appointed them is gone.
Exactly. So the nomination and confirmation process itself becomes this incredibly intense political battleground, which arguably undermines the whole idea of insulating the court from politics.
It's a real double-edged sword.
It really is.
But even with life tenure and the power of judicial review, the court isn't all powerful. Greenhouse stresses the limits, too.
Oh, definitely. This is crucial. The court has no army. It has no police force. It can't appropriate money.
They can't enforce their own rulings, basically?
Not directly. They depend entirely on the other branches, particularly the executive branch, to actually carry out their decisions.
Which brings us to that famous, maybe apocryphal story about President Andrew Jackson.
Right. After a ruling by Chief Justice Marshall that Jackson didn't like, he supposedly said something like, John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it.
Whether he actually said it or not, it perfectly illustrates the point, doesn't it?
It does. Without cooperation, a Supreme Court ruling can be just words on paper. Its power is contingent.
And Congress can push back too, right?
Absolutely. If the court interprets a statute in a way Congress doesn't like, Congress can just pass a new law, clarifying it or changing it.
Or in really big clashes, they can even try to amend the Constitution itself, like they did with the income tax, after a court ruling against it.
Yep, the 16th Amendment. It shows the court doesn't operate in a vacuum. There's this constant dialogue and sometimes conflict with the other branches.
Which leads us to moments where the court's own actions put its legitimacy on the line. Greenhouse points to one case in particular as a real crisis moment.
You're talking about Bush v. Gore, the 2000 election decision.
Yeah. That intervention, basically deciding a presidential election, seemed to expose the court to really intense accusations of partisanship.
It was incredibly controversial. A 5-4 decision split right down ideological lines perceived at the time. Greenhouse portrays it as a serious institutional wound.
But there was something unusual about that decision itself, wasn't there? Something about precedent.
Yes. This is fascinating. The majority opinion explicitly stated that its reasoning was limited to the specific circumstances of that case and should not be treated as binding precedent for future election disputes.
Whoa. So the court itself seemed to signal, this is a one-off, don't build on this.
Yeah.
That's highly unusual.
highly unusual. And critics, of course, seized on that as evidence that the ruling wasn't based on neutral legal principles, but was, you know, a politically motivated outcome. It fueled the very legitimacy concerns the court usually tries so hard to avoid.
So it all comes back to that core theme, the fragility of judicial power.
Exactly. Greenhouse really drives this home. The court's authority isn't automatic, it's earned, and it rests entirely on public trust and the willingness of people and institutions to accept its rulings as legitimate. Persuasion, not force.
And the human element is key to that legitimacy. It's not some abstract machine.
Right. The dynamics between the nine justices, the leadership of the chief, the power of a well-reasoned argument in conference, all these human factors shape the law. It's not a faceless oracle.
Okay, let's try to boil down the biggest takeaways from Greenhouse's analysis. If someone were to ask for the three core truths about the Supreme Court, what would they be?
Well, first, I think, is that paradox of enforcement we talked about. The court has immense authority, but zero power to enforce it alone. Its rulings stick only because we, collectively, agree they should. That public acceptance is everything.
Okay, number one, power depends on acceptance. What's next?
Second, that the whole debate about whether the court is legal or political is kind of a red herring. It's a false choice.
It's always been both.
Always. And the real story, the complexity, lies exactly in that tension. Greenhouse doesn't pretend there's an easy answer or that the tension can be resolved, and that honesty is really valuable.
So, number two, it's always both law and politics, and the tension is the point. Yeah. Got it. And the third?
The third is that constitutional interpretation isn't fixed. It's not like finding the one true meaning frozen in 1787. It's an ongoing conversation.
A conversation between...
Between the past, the text, history, precedent, and the present current values, societal changes, new challenges, the court's job is to manage our national arguments about what the Constitution means today. It adapts.
Okay, great summary. Power relies on acceptance. It's both law and politics, and interpretation is an ongoing conversation.
Yeah.
So why does understanding all this matter for, you know, the average person? Why should you care?
Oh, it matters hugely. First, for just being an informed citizen. Knowing this helps you cut through the noise, the simplistic headlines like activist judges.
Right. Instead of just reacting emotionally, you can actually look at the reasoning, understand concepts like precedent, stare decisis.
Exactly. You can analyze how they reached a decision, not just whether you like the outcome. You can appreciate the constraints they operate under.
And stare decisis, that principle of sticking to past decisions, that's really about maintaining that fragile trust, isn't it? If the rules changed drastically every time a new justice arrived, nobody would trust the court.
Precisely. Reliability is key to legitimacy. And second, understanding this stuff makes the stakes of elections crystal clear.
Because presidents appoint justices.
And those justices can serve for decades.
Yeah.
So when you vote for president, you're not just choosing someone for 4 or 8 years. You are indirectly casting a vote that could shape the direction of American law for a generation or more. That's a massive long-term consequence.
Yeah, that really brings it home. It's not abstract political theory. It's about the future rules we all live under.
And finally, it just fosters critical thinking. Instead of immediately labeling a decision you disagree with as purely political or illegitimate, you can engage with the legal arguments, understand the different judicial philosophies at play, and have a more nuanced view.
Okay, as we wrap up, what's one thing from this deep dive, maybe from Greenhouse's perspective, that really surprised you or stuck with you the most?
For me, I think it's just how contingent that power truly is. We think of the Supreme Court as the final word, this incredibly solid institution. But that Andrew Jackson anecdote, the reliance on the executive branch, the Bush v. Gore non-precedent, it really underscores that its authority isn't guaranteed. It depends on factors outside the court itself. That fragility is kind of mind-blowing when you really think about it.
Yeah, I agree. The fragility is striking. My big takeaway is probably just how human it all is. We want to believe in this objective rule of law, but Greenhouse shows it's inevitably filtered through these nine individuals, their backgrounds, their interactions, their persuasive abilities. It's a reminder that institutions are made of people.
And maybe the most valuable lesson overall is seeing the court as a mirror. It reflects our country's deepest disagreements, our evolving values, our highest ideals. It's messy. It's dynamic because we are messy and dynamic.
So Greenhouse shows us the Constitution isn't about final answers.
Not really. Its genius, maybe, is creating a framework for arguing, for deliberating democratically. The court facilitates that argument, manages it. But ultimately, ensuring its legitimacy, making sure that framework holds. That's on all of us. Informed debate is crucial. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Catra Foundation.